Thank you, everyone, for being here today. We have Munira Shivji. She's our vice chair, and she's in private practice in Vancouver. Villanova Carvalho is our public member, and unfortunately, he wasn't able to attend today. We have Shelley Boardman, who is from Victoria. Thank you. Darlene Russell is from Central BC. Thank you. And then Susan Mulholland is our college staff support. Thanks very much. So this interactive session today intends to provide education and explore how to manage professional boundaries in practice. The specific objectives are to raise awareness about professional boundaries, share and apply practical strategies for managing professional boundaries. The College and the Client Relations Committee are aware that there are many new issues cropping up in practice, particularly given the changes in technology and the use of social networking like Facebook. We want to see what you think and to identify new and current issues related to professional boundaries. So as part of your registration package today, we provided an overview of the session, and then we have it up here as well for you to look at. So it's my special privilege to be able to introduce our speaker today, Eleanor Larney. She is an occupational therapist who's been working with the College of Occupational Therapists of Ontario for over 5 years. In her role as Deputy Registrar, she's been actively involved in registration, quality assurance, patient relations, and practice issues. Through the years, the College of Occupational Therapists of BC and the College of Occupational Therapists of Ontario have had a strong history of collaboration. This pre-AGM session is yet another example of such an endeavor. Please, everyone, welcome Eleanor Larney. Thank you.
Good morning. It's nice to see such a big crowd on a Saturday morning here to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is professional boundaries. I hope we have a good interactive session today. We have a couple of interactive things that we're going to do, and I hope that works with a big crowd like this, which is good. So first of all, are you confident that you could identify a boundary issue? I know I've talked to lots of OTs who say, oh, we don't have boundary issues in OT. Like, our practice is all good. We don't have these problems. But I would suspect that every single occupational therapist has encountered a situation that is a boundary issue. Now, whether it's a problem or not, that's left to decide. Do you know how to avoid crossing a boundary or how to avoid violating a boundary? So all occupational therapy colleges across the country have had discussions about what are the appropriate boundaries between clients and occupational therapists and maybe other people that OTs encounter in their practice. It's really important to understand what boundaries are all about and how to manage them. So we're going to start with a little exercise. And I'm going to ask people to raise their hands and let me know whether you think this is true for you or not. So first one, people with good boundaries are assertive. How many people think that's true? If you've got good professional boundaries, would you be assertive? Raise your hands. How many people think that's true? That's good. How about, do people with good boundaries, do they stay in a problem solver role? Good. I'm not necessarily going to give you all the right answers right now because as we go through, we'll get into what these things are. But it's a little test for yourself. How well do I know about these? What about this one? People with good boundaries can quickly identify what is best for their client. Who thinks that's true? Oh, this is pretty good. I may not have as much to teach you as I thought. Awesome. How about people with good boundaries are in touch with their feelings? They really know what's going on with themselves. Yes, it's true, right? We need to really know ourselves well so we can understand the relationship with our clients. People with good boundaries do not have saying no around treatment options. How many people think that's true? Oh, we're not sure about that one. Sometimes we do have to say no, right? We can't always do what the client always wants us to do. People with good boundaries keep private information private, right? Do you have privacy legislation in this province? Yes, good. People with good boundaries are clear in their various roles in their life. This is an important one, right? If we let our roles blur, sometimes we're not sure where we're doing what. People with good boundaries are able to prioritize a client's goals and keep everyone on track. Who thinks that's true? A couple people. Well, we have to wonder about whether we're getting over-involved if we're sorting everybody else out, right? People with good boundaries are respectful of others' bodies, turf, thoughts, and feelings. Yes, that's important, right? People with good boundaries believe boundaries can be violated if you've got a good explanation. If you've got a good rationale, you can violate a boundary. How many people think that's true? Okay, that's good. How about feel guilty when clients are not making adequate progress? Guilt. Is that a feeling that we should have as therapists related to our clients? We are human, but probably that's something we need to work on. People with good boundaries are responsible for their clients' progress in therapy. How many people think that's true? Oh, that's good. Cautious crowd this morning. People with good boundaries have clear, readable emotions. How many people think that's true? Okay, jury's out. How about people with good boundaries go the extra mile for their client? Okay, well, that was just a little bit of a self-test. You guys seem like a pretty good crowd. Maybe we won't teach you anything new, but hopefully we'll have a good discussion this morning. And we're going to start off with a video, and Susan's going to try and make it work because this is technology in action.
Are you looking forward to coming home soon, Mom?
Yes, I am. I'll be happy to get home out of here and have a nice home-cooked meal.
Hi, Mrs. Renton. How are you today?
Hi, Suji. I'm fine, thanks. I'm going home today. This is my son, Jeff.
Nice to meet you.
Hello.
Jeff.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Suji, your mom's occupational therapist. So today I'm just going to take some measurements of you, Mrs. Renton, so we can get you a properly fitted wheelchair for you to go home. Is that okay with you?
Yes, that's fine.
So how's this wheelchair doing for you right now?
It seems a bit short here for me.
Okay, so let's just get you sitting a little straighter in the wheelchair.
Okay.
That might help things.
Okay, it hurts to move a bit, but okay.
Okay, that's good. All right, so I'm going to have to take a measurement from your knee to over there from behind you. So is that okay?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, so I'm just going to place your arm right here. Okay.
I have been doing some research on the internet lately about equipment that my mother could use when she gets home. There's actually a group on Facebook that discusses that kind of thing. Maybe you'd like to give me your email address and I could invite you on as a friend. It might be pretty good for business.
Oh, I love Facebook. I actually found my old boyfriend on Facebook, and can you believe we're dating right now?
I'm always glad when people laugh at that because that means you get it, right? So what do we think about this situation? Does anybody think they can recognize the boundary issues? There's a few of them. What do we think? So there's an invitation for a personal relationship between the client and the son of Mrs. Ranton, right? So that's one of them. There's disclosing of personal information that's happening with the OT and the family. And really, that kind of personal information really needs to be carefully done and carefully managed when you're disclosing personal information. It really could lead to encouragement of the client to move beyond the therapeutic relationship, which then could impact your ability to be objective in the future. So that's half the problem. So what do you think are the factors that might have contributed to this boundary issue? So what are the things in the environment that you're thinking about? The therapist didn't ask the mother's permission to keep the son there, and so right away there's a risk situation. And having the son there is a risk situation for a few reasons as well. If you think about their age, it's probably a little bit closer together. Maybe he's seeing that there's a possible friendship that could be. He's relating to this young therapist. So that also creates a risk in the environment. Not that those things can't be managed, but it just creates a risk that you have to be aware of. Anything else that you can think of that might contribute to a boundary violation there? Or if she doesn't understand all the issues related to being involved with Facebook, that could be an issue as well. And, of course, she's just blurting all this stuff out and has no boundaries as well. So she's really aware of her boundaries between her own body and the client's body and making sure she's not overstepping that without permission or going too far if she doesn't need to. So that's a very good point. So we think this might be a bit of a high-risk situation. Certainly the therapist's reaction in terms of the Facebook and her boyfriend and sharing all this information is really kind of a high-risk disclosure. I think part of it is to think about whether the therapist would allow this kind of stuff to continue in the future. If she would continue to behave this way with the clients and get onto Facebook with them or have these discussions where she's blurting out personal information about herself, think about her practice in the future and what kinds of problems that she might encounter as she carries on. I think what we'll talk about is what can we do to sort of prevent these things from happening so you have a good therapeutic relationship, because that's really the point. That's the outside goal, right? You want to have a good therapeutic relationship with your clients. So some of the things that, you know, she could do in this situation would be to make sure that she's always behaving professionally. She's keeping her own personal information in check. She's looking at the professional setting, and I like the comment about maybe she should be asking permission from the mother to have other people present in the room because there's a confidentiality issue. So we wanted to spark your interest a little bit with some immediate scenarios, but we want to talk a little bit about what are professional boundaries, learning about what the risks might be, how might you establish professional boundaries in your practice, and then what happens when something goes wrong, because no one's perfect, and sometimes things happen even if you've done everything right. So what to do about that, and then we'll just make sure that you're aware of what the resources are in BC in order to help you with boundary issues. So this is one definition of professional boundaries, and it really is the line between a personal relationship and a professional relationship. And generally, as I said before, the goal of all therapeutic relationships is that they're professional in nature. If the relationship changes to something that's more personal or has personal elements, it can then be less therapeutic and have risk for the relationship related to power, trust, respect, and the exercise of professional judgment. So those are all the risks. Boundaries really do show respect for your clients and respect for yourself as well. And you need to respect the client's individuality, their privacy, their personal space, and their time. And that's what's really about. Therapists have their own privacy, and clients have their own privacy, and you respect each other's. Every occupational therapist is going to encounter a situation where their notion about boundaries will be challenged. It happens to every single person. Lots of therapists are very, very adept at managing these right off. Other people get themselves into trouble. So it's good to sort of be able to think about it cognitively and plan to manage these things ahead of time so you're not having to react. An example is every single time a therapist goes to a home visit, this is a boundary crossing. So you're entering another person's space, and you have to manage this. And you get very, very good at doing this, but it is a boundary crossing right off. You're entering their personal space, and it's usually a personal relationship when you're going to someone's home. You're usually their guest. That's not a professional relationship, so it has to be carefully managed. And it's really better to anticipate these risks and think about how you're going to manage them so you're not running into trouble. So things that therapists can do when they're going to home visits, you wear a name tag. Just by virtue of putting a name tag on establishes that there is a boundary. I'm wearing a name tag. Normally when I'm a guest in someone's home, I don't put my name tag on. So right away, there's a little bit of a different relationship that you're setting the expectation that this is a professional interaction that we're going to have. That's one thing you can do. Also think about your clothing and your dress. If you go very casually dressed, then that might set the tone that maybe you are a guest in their home. But if you dress as a professional person, you're wearing your name tag, you carry your briefcase, you're writing notes, all these things tell the client this is different than having a guest in my home. And it's really important to set that stage. It manages the risks right at the outset. So there's many types of boundaries, and I've got a whole list here. But there can be also unconscious boundaries. So sometimes you might have a reaction to a client and you're not really sure why. But what's important to understand is I can't necessarily always act on my feelings. So there might be a client for some reason I don't like, or I seem to like a lot. But it's important to be objective and treat all your clients the same way and realize that sometimes unconscious influences can play a part in the relationship we have, even in a professional way. And it's really, really important to make sure you're keeping all of these things on a professional level. So if you think about all of these kind of boundaries, so emotional boundaries, if you've had a stressful day and then you're going into the client session, that's a boundary that could be crossed because you might be more vulnerable to having more open boundaries. And it's important always to make sure we have to recognize that there's a power imbalance with our clients. And if the therapist's needs start needing to be met by the client, you've shifted the power. And it's not a very good thing to do because clients really need to trust the therapist is going to manage the relationship. And you don't want the client having to provide support to the therapist. So it's really important to manage your emotions and that sort of thing. Other things create boundaries. So if you've had a very strong lunch and you come and you smell like garlic or whatever, that creates a boundary between you and your client because they're not going to want to get very close with you and it's automatically going to set a boundary. Sometimes you might want to do that on purpose. Seriously, it's just a good thing to notice, right? You're going to notice what are the things that set up boundaries. smell, even wearing perfume, is something as well that will set up a boundary between you and your clients. And what's important to know is, do you want to have strong boundaries or do you want to have loose boundaries? And that's what, when you're looking around at your clients and you're saying, well, who am I treating here? What is my environment like? What kind of boundaries do I need to set? When you're working with pediatrics, you probably can set pretty loose boundaries. You're going to wear more casual clothes, you're going to get down on their level, you're going to speak in different kind of language, you're going to make your boundaries pretty loose because you want to create this trusting relationship, and it's okay when you're working with pediatrics. If you're working in a penitentiary, you probably want to have pretty strong boundaries because you want to be careful that, you know, you're setting clear delineation of where you're working. Working with adolescents is one of the tricky ones because they actually really respond to very loose boundaries, but they may actually need more strict boundaries. So it's really important to sort of see what the needs of your clients are and also gauge their reaction, because you want to make sure always that your relationship is professional. So why do we have to establish boundaries? I think we've talked about it a little bit, but clients really need to feel secure that the professional can manage the situation and manage any behaviors that occur. We don't know what has gone on in clients' lives and what they're bringing to that relationship, so you have to manage these things ahead of time. And really, the professional needs to be in charge of the relationship, and that's part of the professional and the power. And, you know, lots of times therapists will say to me, well, you know, OTs, we're very client-centered, and we need to reduce that power. We need to be equal. But while you don't want to create a huge power imbalance such that you're dictating and you want to be client-centered, being client-centered is very different from having a personal relationship with a client. You still have the power. You still need to be objective. If you're having an unequal relationship or the power shifts to the client, it's very, very difficult for OTs to then exercise their professional judgment in an objective way. So that's really important to know those things. Getting too close with your client, so allowing that boundary to open up too much and become a little bit personal, can really promote burnout, because then you are starting to have that personal relationship where you're starting to take on the feelings of your client, and there's too much sympathy as opposed to empathy going on, and you can burn out. And it's really important when we're constantly dealing with people who need things from us that we are managing that as well, because we want people to have long, satisfying careers, right? So therapists also need to take the time to understand their own needs and their own pressures and make sure they're not bringing these into their relationships with their clients, because our relationships with our clients should always put the clients first. If the therapist needs start needing to be met in that therapeutic relationship, we know there's something wrong. So being self-aware is really, really important. If you're going through some tough times in your personal life or even at your work life, you need to figure out a way to deal with those things so they're not brought into your clinical situation with your clients. It's really, really important. That self-awareness is so important. And sometimes these things can be unconscious as well. So watching for signs of, you know, this really should be stressing me out. We've all learned about this. We all know how to see this in our clients. We need to see it in ourselves as well. So the elements of a therapeutic relationship, it's really important to understand what they are. So the first one is power, and we talked about the power imbalance. It needs to be acknowledged and it needs to be respected. Trust is the next one. Clients need to feel secure that the boundaries of the relationship will be focused on their best interest and not meeting the needs of the therapist. Respect needs to be there, so differences in beliefs, religion, race, all those things need to be respected. Empathy versus sympathy. In empathy, the occupational therapist can objectively understand the client's situation. In sympathy, there may be an expression of emotion which can be overwhelming and affect objective decision-making when it comes to the client if it's not well managed. And also the exercise of professional judgment. An OT must be able to apply their judgment in an objective manner and not let subjective personal reactions interfere. So there's many things that could influence the seriousness of a boundary crossing, and it's a continuum. So a boundary crossing can happen, and sometimes we allow it to happen on purpose, but it always has to be done consciously. If you're going to allow a boundary crossing to happen, you've got a therapeutic outcome in mind. Sometimes it'll be a whoops, and then you've got to fix it. But for example, you might decide that you're going to disclose some personal information about an experience that you had because you want to establish rapport and you want to open up a conversation. But you must realize at that time that, yes, this is a boundary crossing. Disclosing personal information is a boundary crossing. You need to do it consciously. You need to say, I know I'm doing this, but I'm using it for a therapeutic purpose, and then I'm going to reestablish those boundaries again. Because one of the things about personal information is that when you start disclosing that to a client, they may very well see it as an invitation to start a personal relationship with you. And then it flips the relationship into a personal one rather than a professional one. And then all of a sudden, you can get sucked into that. It's a bit of a slippery slope, and all of a sudden now this patient, the power differential has changed, you can't be objective anymore, and it just can go haywire. So it's good to be aware of when you're crossing a boundary, because it's allowed. Boundary crossings happen for all kinds of reasons, but to know that it's happening and set the boundaries once again when you're ready to do that. So a boundary violation. Now this is where there's a potential of harm, or there's harm that has been done to the client. So one definition is when the nature of the therapeutic relationship moves from being a professional one to also being a personal one. And a real extreme example of this could be sexual abuse. Thank goodness we don't have too much of that going on. We don't have too much of it going on in Ontario. I'm assuming that it's the same thing here in BC. This is not a big problem. But there is examples that we have where therapists are dating their clients. In Ontario, any time a client has sexual relationships with a professional, it's considered abuse. And so that's one of the things that we take very seriously. We, thank goodness, haven't had any complaints about this. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's not happening, but we just haven't heard about it. And the thing is that when you're probably a less obvious thing is when we're dating our clients, right? So that can sometimes happen. You think, you know, I'm getting on well with this person, and we'll start dating. And all these things work well when the relationship is going well. But it's when the relationship starts falling apart that all of a sudden the boundary issues come to light. And I'll give you an example of this. And it's a physiotherapy example that's public in Ontario, happened a while ago. A physiotherapist was dating her client, and they got married, and everything was good, and then they had a messy divorce. And what the previous client, who was the husband, said, well, I married her because she was my therapist, and I was in awe of her, and I thought she was so wonderful. So you see that there was still a power imbalance that was happening in that relationship, or at least this is what the person said, and then used it against her, made a complaint to the college, and basically they felt that this was a relationship that shouldn't have happened to begin with, because once the power imbalance start changing and the relationship changes, then everything goes haywire. So it's not a good thing. Another example of a boundary crossing might be is if you've had a bad day and you're venting your emotions. Oh, I'm so stressed out, this bad thing just happened. Well, what ends up happening there now is you put that client in a role reversal. They're meant to now be helping you, and all of a sudden your needs are being met instead of theirs. And we might say that this could be a violation, because now basically you've wasted their time, you've destabilized the relationship, they don't feel secure anymore that you can handle any situation, you lose your credibility, all this stuff happens. If an occupational therapist starts becoming friends with a client, the same thing can happen. Boundary violations really do serve the occupational therapist's needs. It can be this role reversal. It could be when there's secrets held. Now, sometimes clients will tell you a secret. Now, a secret is different than confidential information, because confidential information, there's rules about who you're allowed to share things with. But if a client tells you a secret, a secret is a personal thing. It's something you would tell a friend or a confidant. But it's not something you tell a professional. So if you're being asked to keep a secret, then you might want to think about that, because that's probably a boundary issue. And what have you done to make your client think that telling you secrets is allowed? Because, you know, maybe it's something that said, well, I've gone out drinking on the weekend, and they're in for rehab, alcohol rehab, whatever. And they said, I've gone out drinking on the rehab, please don't tell the team. This is a secret. And they should know right up front that secrets are not allowed. We're in a professional relationship. Outcomes of boundary violations. The worst one, of course, is sexual misconduct. That is severe harm that would be done to the client in that case. But can also lead to a conflict of interest, really, where you're now unsure of what's in the best interest of your client, because some of your needs are involved in the relationship. There could be a loss of the therapeutic relationship, loss of trust, loss of credibility, and, of course, ultimately the worst thing is any harm that comes to clients. Conflict of interest can be the result of a boundary violation of a personal nature when the OT is meeting their own needs in the situation rather than the client's. This can be an emotional conflict of interest, or it can be something more tangible like a financial conflict of interest. This is a completely different topic, like it's not a different topic, but it can take a whole session just talking about different kinds of conflict of interest. occupational therapists can get into these personal relationship kinds of conflict of interest when they're not managing the boundaries well within their professional work. So some of the warning signs of boundary violations, because sometimes, you know, you can be oblivious to this kind of going on because you're busy at work and you may be having some personal stresses and not being very reflective. These things happen to people, we're all human. If you're starting to exchange gifts and home phone numbers or personal information with clients, or you're doing that, I'm so stressed out, I can't believe this thing just happened, those are probably things that we shouldn't be sharing with clients. And if you find yourself doing that, you need to stop and say, what's going on with me? I need to deal with my own stuff. Extending the care of a client unnecessarily. So, you know, you've decided that for some reason this client is really responding extra well and you seem to be doing extra good, and I really think I need way more sessions with this person. Is this more than everyone else is getting? That might be a sign as well that you're heading down a slippery slope. If you're having emotional reactions to certain clients, like a strong dislike or a strong like, it could be a transference, counter-transference kind of thing going on, and you may also want to think, well, is there a boundary issue going on? Why am I having these reactions to people? I shouldn't be acting on these emotional responses, but I need to be aware that they're happening. Any special privileges or considerations? It could also be a clue. I'm doing special favors for someone. I'm extending my hours. I'm coming in on a day I don't normally work. And I might not do that for every client, but I'll do it for this one. That kind of thing. That could be a sign. Could be a warning sign that something's going on. If you're excessively touching someone, so you find you have a client that you always want to touch their arm, or you always want to pat them or do something, that might give you a clue that you're having a reaction to this client that maybe could be inappropriate. And while that particular thing is not inappropriate, it could lead down a slippery slope where more things start happening. Some of the other questions to ask yourself are you comfortable recording this activity in the chart? So something that you've done, an interaction that you've had, would you write it in a chart? If you don't think it's chartable, that might tell you that, maybe this is something that shouldn't have happened. Does the action that you're working with contribute to a client's goals? That's another question that you might be able to ask yourself. So what goal is this meeting when I'm doing this thing with this client? Would you be able to record that activity in your workload statistics? So would you be able to bill for it? If you can't bill for it or record it in statistics, it may not be contributing to the client's goals, and it may be a boundary thing versus a therapeutic thing. Would you feel comfortable talking to your colleagues or your supervisor about the activity or the interaction that just occurred? These are good questions to ask yourselves when you're wondering, is this a boundary violation or isn't it? Because you're not always objective when you're in that situation. So preventing them, it's way better to check ahead, look around at your practice environment and figure out what things can be put in place and what things do I need to think about to prevent boundary violations rather than fixing them afterwards. So things to reflect on would be, is there any gender issues here? Am I a young female working mostly with young males? Is this going to be a problem? Or am I a young female working with a lot of people who are my parents' age and they all see me as their daughter? That could be another one, so you're going to have lots of interactions that way. These things might not be bad, but it could be that maybe your mother passed away several years ago and you have this unconscious need to have this relationship with an older lady. And so this could be a real problem in terms of being objective and that sort of thing. So knowing yourself, knowing your clients, what are your needs and the needs of your clients as well. If you're working in pediatrics, lots of times the clients are the kids, but their parents are the same age as you are. And I used to work in pediatrics, and I remember the therapist saying to me, gosh, you know, if they weren't my client, I'd really want to be their friends because I really get along with them well. We live in the same community. Like, I really, really think this would be a good relationship, but I have to stop myself because I know it's not appropriate to socialize with my client's parents because I might be the one saying, no, you can't have this piece of equipment later on, or we can only give you this much or whatever, right? So that's the difficulty. Things about your practice. So are you primarily doing home visits? Are you out by yourself a lot where you don't have other people around? Are these risky things that are happening in your practice? What about OTs who work in primarily rural areas where you know everybody almost personally that you're working with? This can be extremely tricky. How do you manage this? You can't not work. So this is another thing. So how do you manage that? We can talk about that a little bit later. Sometimes it's really good to establish some policies that you can be upfront about. So you might decide a no gift giving policy, because we talk about gifts, and gifts really are a personal expression. So if I give you a gift, it's like a birthday present or something, it's a personal expression of whatever you want to say, I value you, I like you, I want to be with you, here's a gift. In a professional relationship, generally, there's payment or there's workload stats and the government pays you or however it works. It's not necessarily a gift that you're expecting or that is required. So as soon as a gift is being given, it's a personal expression, and managing that can be very tricky. So sometimes establishing a no gift giving policy does put you in that situation of not having to turn it down, because it's really awkward. Someone's gone and bought you something and thank you very much, and you're thinking, oh, I really shouldn't be accepting this because it's going to cause problems later on. But now you're in this sticky situation. It's better to say right up front on your policies, on your brochure, we are here to serve you, gifts are not required, stuff like that. Remember to always think about what's in the best interest of your client. When you're not sure about whether an activity is appropriate or not appropriate, ask yourself, what is in the best interest of this client? And also ask yourself, am I trying to meet my needs here? What are my needs in this situation? And remember to always focusing on the client will help you as well figure out what the right thing is to do. It's important to also think about who are our clients and try not to get into a dual relationship. So a dual relationship is when you've got two competing interests. And one might be, so if you're treating your financial advisor, for example, that could be a problem because they're needing to give you a service and you need to give them a service, and now all of a sudden there's a big power imbalance where the power has flipped over and you cannot exercise proper professional judgment anymore and you can't be objective. That's a real problem to get into those kind of situations. Even working with your real estate agent, people who you have another relationship, taking them also on as a client can really cause problems in exercising professional judgment and objectivity. So what happens when something goes wrong? Because it's going to happen to every single person. They're going to leave an interaction and they're going to go, oh, I can't believe that just happened. And we're all human. We all want to have relationships. We are social beings as well. It's going to happen. And also, and being so ultra-conscious all the time about needing to be professional is hard work. You want to like your patients. You want to have good interactions with them. But if it goes a step too far, what do we do? So I think it's important to, first of all, be so self-aware that you know what's happened. Don't beat yourself up about it, but say, okay, what do I need to do? How do I reestablish this boundary? Does it mean having a discussion with the person that the boundary's been violated or crossed with? Does it mean changing my behaviors? Does it mean shifting this client over to somebody else because I can no longer have appropriate boundaries anymore with this person? Talking to other people can really help, because sometimes you do need an objective ear. It's really important to say, what should I do? Use the resources that you have. You're probably working with more experienced people. You might have a manager. You've got Susan here at the college who you can call if you really don't know what to do. All those things can help you. You're never in this by yourself, and that's important to know too. We actually had a call at the college one time where a therapist called us and she was in tears. I'm a bad therapist. I'm reporting myself to the college because I went out on a date with my client. And so we said, okay, well, just I'll stop. It's glad, you know, we're glad that you recognize this. We're glad that you now realize you've got to do something about this. So what are we going to do? You cannot be dating your client. So you need to break that off right away. It doesn't mean that your client necessarily won't call us to complain about you later. That's a risk. But you need to do what you can do right now to make this right and reestablish those boundaries. Very, very important. If you are having stuff that you need to work on, get the help that you need so you're not bringing it into your client relationships. It's really important. We all go through periods of time in our lives where sometimes we need help to get through something. We should all know that help is really going to work because we provide that help sometimes. Sometimes we need to work on our own stuff. So here are some of the resources available to you, some of them from your college. The college in BC has a code of ethics, and that's really helpful to look at when you're wondering how to reflect on your own behavior and then what's going on in your practice. There's guidelines, drawing the line, so establishing professional boundaries. There's a college communique on sexual misconduct. And there's a handout on your table, I believe, that can help you do a little bit of self-reflection. So what we're going to do now is some interactive activities. So on your table, you've got a folder a brown folder, and there's some scenarios in there that we'd like to, you to take time and discuss at your table. We're going to give you 10 minutes to sort of talk a little bit about the boundary issues. Now that you've heard all the theory, the boring dry stuff, you get a chance to apply it to a scenario that you might encounter. And we're going to give you 10 minutes to talk about it, and then we're going to come back and see what you came up with and do some interactive question and answer stuff. So we have a couple of people wandering around. This is going to be like a Phil Donahue thing. I'm showing my age, sorry. But so I can hear you, and so everybody else can hear you. We're going to have the ladies with the mic come around if you're going to speak. So we had three scenarios, and they were interspersed among the tables. And so maybe people, which tables had the call-in scenario? Can you just show me your hands? So these three had the call-in scenario. Okay, so for the other tables who didn't have it, I'll just quickly read it. So you're working with a client, Colin, who had a motorbike accident and has a spinal cord injury. He is in active rehab and you've been working on transfers in the independent living unit. Following your last session where you had worked on bed transfers, the psychologist on the team advised you that the client felt you were making sexual advances during therapy. So, who wants to talk first about their thoughts about this and how they might handle the situation of the three groups? Who has a burning thing they want to say? There's no right or wrong answers, there's just thoughts, feelings, ideas.
So we talked that it'd be important to, before approaching the client, to do some personal reflection on what was happening that day, what our perception of what our intention was, how we were communicating with the client, what do we know about the client, his history, and then to talk with a team member or a supervisor to use our resources, and also to consider what our relationship is with the psychologist as well. So all that leading to developing some kind of risk assessment and plan as to how we're going to approach the client. We talked about when we did approach the client, if that was the plan, to talk about how we're going to consent for the discussion, whether or not we were going to do that one-to-one or with another colleague, what the plan was going to be for an ongoing therapeutic relationship and ongoing consent for care. We talked about our own personal needs and our own expectation of closure and whether or not that the client actually is going to help us get that, or whether maybe the client isn't going to help us get any closure on the event. And also if there's any implications on ongoing practice process. So whether or not this client's going to be labeled as always needing two people, or if we can be a little bit more purposeful in moving forward. And we talked about workplace attire, maybe thinking about what we were wearing on the day.
Okay, that was a good answer. Which other table had this one? Let's start here. Do you have anything else you want to offer or to add to this?
We were a little bit more concrete in our approach. We felt that the therapist should have clearly explained what she was trying to accomplish that day in practicing bed transfers and to document that. And following the discussion with the psychologist, she should let her direct supervisor know what was going on and check the workplace policy around sexual advancement from clients and discuss with the psychologist what exactly the client reported and document the psychologist's concern as reported by the client. We were not sure if that should go in the client file or if the therapist should document that personally. And then when in doubt, contact the college as to course of action.
Good. Okay, so do we think that we would record this in the client's file? How many people say yes? Should it go in the file? There's some tentative hands, right? Let's talk about that, because that's a big issue, right? So here's an interaction that happened with a client that sort of affects you personally, and it's really uncomfortable. And obviously, you know, in this situation, we know the OT did not mean, and certainly was not making sexual advances. We're going to just lay that out there. What do people think about, should we put this in the chart or not? Because, and tell us why. I see a big nod over there. Do you want to tell us why you think it should go?
It creates a bit of transparency around the situation, and it brings it to the forefront in a way that there wasn't anything to hide, and you're creating clarity about what the perception was, and then dealing with the steps that were taken to address that perception. So it brings it out into the open and removes that perception and the grayness around the situation.
You know, we could also medicalize it a little bit too, right? So here's a spinal cord injured fellow, there may be an undetected head injury that's going on there, a little bit of disinhibition. And so therefore, this might be one of the risks of working with this kind of client population, is that this kind of thing probably happens a lot in this kind of population. Maybe not this exact thing, but that there's a sexual innuendo that goes on when we're working with young males who are injured in some way and may have a head injury either detected or not. There's a comment way back here.
This is a report from a psychologist. It's hearsay,
okay,
right? So do you report every step, write every step, or do you go through the process and then report, write the end outcome and the process you went through?
There's a comment here.
We were the third table with Colin's scenario, and one of the steps that we had was talking to either our colleagues or supervisors, and that as part of our policies and procedures, we would hope to have an incident form, and that steps would actually be already laid out as to guide us on how to record, when to record, and actually how to follow up, so that we would have maybe thought about this even beforehand,
mm-hmm,
and then would not have to be under that stressful situation making all these decisions at that time.
Right.
And it would be then put on the client's chart as part of that incident form.
Good. So did your table have anything else you wanted to say about the whole entire situation?
Those answers were pretty on par with what we had mentioned, and maybe even looking at the environment for the future in terms of thinking about, was there anything that we had done that could have been perceived as a sexual advancement, and then changing that,
right,
maybe not doing it in his room, doing it in a more public setting with family present or friends present or even other clients present.
So when you're looking at this particular situation, I like the fact that there are people who are thinking, let's be proactive, because you know, obviously we didn't think about this ahead of time. Maybe we were in a closed room situation and we didn't sort of think, goodness, I'm working with this population. What kind of boundaries do I need to set up so that I don't have a risk? Not that it's going to eliminate this risk completely, but how can I minimize the chances of anything going wrong? So when you're a young female OT population and you're working with young males who possibly have a head injury, maybe not, but either way, this is already a situation that could be set up for misinterpretation or whatever. So thinking about it in terms of a risk management way, thinking about it ahead of time. Not that we want to label our clients. I mean, sometimes we have to for a risk management situation. Maybe this is a client who's highly sexualized with other people as well. Or maybe he's just picked on you for whatever reason. So thinking about that, in this kind of a high-risk situation, do we have doors open? Do we have a walkthrough policy such that other therapists enter the room when we know that these things are going on? So just that looking around, but also dealing with that reflection as well. Was there something that I did? But I also think you can't beat yourself up as well, but it's good to think about what are the boundaries that I need to set up to prevent these things from happening again. Now, does anybody else want to weigh in on this situation, having heard all the discussion? No? I think that was pretty good. So let's move on to the next one. So this is Brenda. This is a boundary, actually, with a student. So you have a student, Brenda, on a fieldwork placement and very quickly establish a friendly relationship with her. You are a fairly new therapist and you're almost the same age. You work in a small community and you realize that your student is spending a lot of time alone. After a couple of weeks, you wonder whether you should invite the student out to a movie. You feel that the student would benefit from some socialization and you really hit it off. All right, so which tables had this one? I'll try to remember. Okay, I'm going to pick on this big one in the back now because I've got the right one.
So we took a bit of a concrete look at this, and when we looked at the risk assessment, basically we wanted to make sure that we're aware of the power differential that existed. And secondly, we wanted to be able to recognize that the student is isolated and that there's a mentorship relationship going on here too. And to examine that mentorship role, but we also need to be able to manage that role too. And we ask ourselves the question, does this help to meet the learning objectives of that student? Well, we want to make sure that we've established our clear boundaries. We also want to acknowledge the role and discuss the potential issues around the role that we have as being that preceptor. And look at self-reflection. So what will the invitation do to your professional relationship and the choice of activity that you're looking at? Is it okay that you're going to a movie versus having dinner with the person, etc.?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Who else wants to weigh in? On this table back here.
Thank you. I think we were quite similar, but I think we highlighted a bit more, aside from it being difficult to revert back to a feedback role if there are problems in the actual placement, it becomes your norm, possibly, that you befriend your students, and so that can jeopardize whatever institution you're working for taking on future students there in case it goes awry. Mm-hmm. And I think that's about it. Did you see anything different there? Yeah. It opens up invitation to more discussions of personal nature, and you kind of go down that slippery slope. And it's hard to get back into the more objective, professional role that you should have been having all along. Start mm-hmm. serving your own needs, which is the wrong direction.
Okay. There's a comment back here.
So this table took two different tacks. One, we want to take a look at the therapist and wonder what needs she's not meeting. And so maybe she's the one that's lonely. And so she's trying to get her needs met with the student. The other one, as a manager who also takes students, there's the issue of recruitment. And I really want this student to like my community and want to come back here and work. And so if she's not getting involved in my community, I might take steps to help her get involved. But we discussed it more at a team level and not so much an individual level.
Okay, that's good. Because I was thinking, I can imagine being a student lonely up in a rural placement where I didn't know anyone. And I might think, gosh, I'm sitting here watching TV by myself all the time. And maybe it would be nice to go out and be a little bit social. What if you wanted to perpetrate that as a therapist and said, you know, I feel kind of sorry for this person because she's all by herself. Perhaps you could invite the whole team to go with you. Perhaps, you know, mitigate it in that kind of way. So there's ways of handling these, and there's not a right or wrong answer, but there's a way to say, how can I make this more of a professional outing as opposed to a personal thing between myself and this one student? So there's a way of handling that as well. So you might decide in your situation, there's no way we should be taking our students out to movies ever. Or you might decide, you know what, it's probably a good idea, but we have to manage the risk. Because it really does depend on the situation, and you need to be aware of whether you're meeting your own needs, which is a good way to look at it, and whether you're helping that therapist feel comfortable in that community and just having some compassion for a human being, right? So there's a way of dealing with it. Just an aside on students, we just recently put out standards for student supervision, and I had a group of three students from McMaster University do a survey for me, and we asked therapists in our province, what are the issues they have with students? Overwhelmingly, boundary issues with students came up. Huge. Things like therapists asking students to walk their dogs, taking them, because if they had a home office, this is a real issue, right? You're a community therapist, you work out of a home office, you bring your student with you to your home office. Could you walk my dog while I finish writing this thing? Doing stuff like that, and this is really, really distressing to students when they're put in this position. You're laughing, but apparently this happens. So this was the biggest issue that students had with therapists, is managing the boundaries, because students also want the therapist to be in charge. They want to feel secure that they're going to be evaluated objectively and that their personal relationship isn't going to interfere. And, you know, with all relationships, if there's a power imbalance, the person with the least amount of power, it's normal human nature, they want to try and balance out the power however they can. So they're going to be pushing the limits. And so you have to be the one who is in charge and is setting those limits and making them and being conscious about it. Gerard, so you've been working with a client, Gerard, on a rehab unit for several weeks. He is about to be discharged. In appreciation of the work you've done, he offers you two tickets to the Vancouver Canucks game. I assume they're hard to come by. You tell him that it is unnecessary, but he can't go anyways, and he wants you to take them. He says it would mean a lot to him, and he'd be able to repay you for all your hard work. What do we do? Who had that one? So that must be some of these front tables. Yep. Do you guys want to start? Tell us what you came up with.
We sort of talked about very immediate responses at the beginning. So to remind him that it's our work and our job to forward his rehabilitation, and so we don't need a reward for that. And then we talked about validating his thoughts and making him aware that we appreciated his offer, and that was sufficient for us, that we didn't need to take a gift from him, and then to perhaps offer some alternatives of who he could offer the tickets to as a practical way of sort of defusing it. And then we talk more about being more reflective on our practice and making sure that we have policies introduced to the client at the beginning about gift giving, so to prevent it in the future. And then we had a lot of discussion around the gray area around what a gift is and whether culturally or given the practice model in our setting, what kind of gifts might be appropriate and how that could be managed within each practice setting.
This gift-giving thing is a hot topic, I tell ya. Okay, who else wants? That was a really good answer. Who else wants to? I think these guys over here. Yep.
In our group, we were talking about we should set up some procedures saying that if people give us gifts, if it is a big one, they should direct it to the foundation or something like that so that they can handle it. If it is a small gift like chocolate, and I think the team was thinking that we should accepting it because it's a token of appreciation from the client, and we should just share it with the team, and as long as we stated that, it might be okay.
So can you tell me why sharing it with the team makes it different than keeping it personally for yourself?
We felt that because chocolate is usually very common, mm-hmm. We just felt that this might be okay.
Sometimes people will share a gift because then it takes away that personal thing.
Yeah.
You can say, I'm going to share this to the whole team, so you're diffusing that destabilizing of the power, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Continue.
And we also have a discussion regarding people or the staff will, you know, second people to donate some of the wheelchair or the equipment to the department. And we thought that it should be some facility already have it in their policy and saying that if you finish with the equipment and if you want to deal with that, this is the step. Either you can donate it to the department or we can help you to sell it or whatever. And so that will eliminate some of the problems.
So having those clear policies about how those things are handled, and it's fairly always the same way. Mm-hmm. Gift giving is a really, it's a big issue, isn't it? And who thinks that we should just accept gifts? Sometimes people do think that. It can be really, really tricky, and definitely setting up policies and procedures ahead of time, because what you really are trying not to do is allow that gift to interfere with your objectivity. And remember, gifts is a personal expression, and if somebody wants to express personal stuff with you, they're starting to get into that power relationship. They're trying to decrease your power. Not that we have to be aware of the power. We're not trying to have huge amounts of power, but we need to maintain a certain amount so we can be objective, say no when we have to, and not allow our personal conflicts to interfere with our exercise of professional judgment. So that's really what it's all about. I'll give you an example of something that happened. Actually, one of the committee members on our patient relations committee, he works in mental health, and he had a client who was manic and was going through a severe episode, and he'd gone out and spent all his money on a big screen TV. Then when he realized, I can't pay my rent, I have no money for food, I need to sell this thing, he said to the therapist, I will sell you this TV really, really cheap because I'm doing you a favor, you're doing me a favor, it's going to help me out a lot because I need this money. And the therapist actually said, oh gosh, you know, I was put in a real bad spot because I felt bad for the guy. He said, I probably could have used the TV, I would have got a good deal. But afterwards, he says, you know, you just think of the repercussions. That in that moment, it might have been okay. The guy could pay his rent maybe, and you've helped him out. But the next moment, and as the relationship has now been destabilized, it's going to cause all kinds of problems. And you can just imagine how that might just escalate. You've changed the whole power. The therapist now feels beholden because he's gotten sort of a benefit that he shouldn't have gotten from this therapeutic relationship. So it was just an interesting example that I thought I would share with you guys to show. Sometimes you think you're helping people out, but in the end, you're going to cause a problem in the long term. So I think that comes to the end of our session, and thank you very much for your participation. I think Susan has another activity that she would like you to do.
Thank you, Eleanor. I'm just going to switch gears here for a few minutes. The Client Relations Committee has been working really hard with the college. I've been working with them. And one of the objectives of today is just to get a feel for what's happening out there from your perspective. The Client Relations Committee would like to be able to come back later in the year and have a feel for what's happening out there, and perhaps are the guidelines that we're using still current? Are there any new issues emerging that we need to be aware of or perhaps addressing or looking at in more detail? You have a package on your table, which I think everybody's found, and there's a beautifully color coordinated green form there, and that's what we'll be looking at for the next 10 or 15 minutes. There's four instructions on it. One is that I'm going to give you 5 minutes to complete the form on your own, just to have a real think about what's happening in your area of practice. Then I'll get you to spend 5 minutes just discussing it at your table, and then I'll do a real quick look around the room just to hear the different perspectives. Just so that you know, we will be collecting this green form because, as I said, the Client Relations Committee wants to be able to have a look at this information. We're not asking for your name. We're just asking where you work and what area of practice so we can have a sense of the context that you're coming from with your perspective. So I'll let you get started on that. I just would like to hear, I'd like to focus actually on question 2. Are there any new areas where you think there's current or potential boundary issues that you're seeing? And we're really curious to hear from your perspective. We do have Darlene and Shelley on the roving mics again, so here we go.
I work in mental health, and we are moving towards a philosophy of family engagement. And we know we have the whole issue of confidentiality, but we also have the issue of continuity of care. And I think that within our organisation there's a lot of discussion going on around these issues. And I suppose for me, listening to the presentation today, nothing is cut and dry. Mm-hmm. And so often what you have to do is look at the policy, like legislative policy as well as policies in organisations, and models of care, and stand back and discuss all of those things and be able to problem solve through to what is in the best interest of the client. Because not every policy is in the best interest of the client, but some policies are. So I think that nothing is that straightforward. So there's one example for me. The second example is within mental health we are trying to engage, where appropriately, opportunities for individuals with mental illness to get engaged in participating and planning development of service as well as move into meaningful roles within the mental health community. And that may be to move into a position as a colleague. So at one moment you may have been a therapist for an individual and the next moment you are a colleague of that individual. So what does this mean as far as our relationships? So I think that we do need to have some thought put into these kinds of issues, because on the one hand we're hearing that you should never have a relationship with an individual, and then the role has shifted, and what would this mean? Right. So those are two examples for me within my own practice where I think the whole issue of professional boundaries does need to be looked at.
Thank you. And what I'm hearing from your comments and your two examples is there's new approaches and different approaches and models of practice, and we need to have the professional boundaries issue in our forefront when we're looking at some of those pieces and how they're going to unfold. Any other areas or comments people would like to make? Les?
The one area that really comes to the forefront for me is the social networking aspect of things. Working in pediatrics, it's a small network across the province, even though we're widely distributed. But what we are finding is that there's a lot of people who may be colleagues, etc., that go on Facebook or LinkedIn or any other social media, and they're friending parents, clients, etc. But sometimes they'll be making comments about their colleagues or their working situation, and they don't realize that this is viewable by hundreds of people. And they also don't realize that it's going to reflect back on them as a professional and their career in general.
Yeah, thank you, and your comments well taken. That's one of the reasons this session was called Professional Boundaries. Is there an app for that? Because I know at the college and just speaking with the Client Relations Committee, the social media, the internet, the email, the quick access to information, and the blurring, the physical blurring of boundaries and environments is really in the forefront right now, and it's something we're all, I think, tackling with. One last comment I can take, and then just so you know, we're going to shift into the next section, which is open for questions and answer time. So any other particular new areas someone wants to highlight? Oh, okay, we've got two, so we can start here.
Just as a pediatric OT in private practice, given our economic climate, increasing requests for bartering for services. And
interesting,
that's a bit of an issue, yeah.
Thank you. And last comment over here.
So in acute care, the push for discharge, earlier discharge, shorter length of stay continues. And I think the danger of that is that the therapist will use whatever mean they can to promote that, and sometimes that could be using a student to knock down a wall for renovation, or recommending some personal services that would help the client to be discharged early, and justify by saying that they're helping the system.
Thank you. I'm really interested to hear how diverse just even those four or five comments that I've heard. I'm looking forward to the green forms and reading them and pulling together the information. So next we're going to have a section called Learning from Our Colleagues. We will have Kathy Corbett, the registrar with the College of OTs of BC, on the stage, also with Eleanor Larney from the College of OTs of Ontario. Learning from our colleagues is going in many directions here. Ontario, they have approximately 4,800 OTs registered, and in BC we're sitting at approximately 2,000 right now. So between the two colleges, a lot of learning has been going on in this area of professional boundaries, but also we're wanting some interaction back and forth from the audience. So as I said, I'm going to open it up for questions for Kathy and Eleanor to respond to. Heather?
Something that we in our program are running up against lately, and I think, again, it's a sign of the economy, is medical vendors are becoming very difficult, I guess. And a lot of them are popping up in shopping malls and enticing clients, and a lot of the population that I work with is elderly and very vulnerable. And a lot of them also require occupational therapy involvement because they are looking for third-party funding, whether it's extended health or veterans or whatever, and getting the call from the client that I've found this great wheelchair at such and such a store, and this is the one that I want, and I know that that's, or at least I suspect that that is not a well-recognized vendor, and some of the third-party funders do have the contracts, so that is, fortunately, that's something that can be used, but it's really difficult to have that conversation, and I think it sort of fits into this professional boundary thing as to not looking like you're being negative to a business, but at the same time protecting the client by saying, you know, maybe this isn't the best way to go. And it's becoming more and more and more of a concern for us.
One of the things that I think that happens when you're dealing with boundary issues and things that are uncomfortable, you're really trying to do the best thing for your client, right? And also work within a system that has constraints. We really, as occupational therapists, have some incredible skills. And one of those skills that we really need to employ is our communication skills. And I think we can get ourselves out of lots of sticky situations by transparency when we're discussing with clients, letting them know all of their options, and using our communication skills to really just lay it out. This is how this works, and I just need to let you know about this, that, and the other. One of the things that we're finding actually in Ontario, if you want to bring that in here, is that there's getting more and more of a push that people should be able to make a living, and less worry on the constraints that we might have in terms of ethical decision making, and more on people have a right to earn a living. And so the business people are starting to destabilize the whole milieu. So we're coming across some of this stuff as well. We have probably some different dynamics because of our assistive devices program, that sort of thing. But that's just one of the things that I would offer in terms of dealing with some of the situations, is using really good, clear, transparent communication skills, because that is our gift, really, to our clients, is being as direct as possible with them.
Yeah, I'll try to tackle. I think there, certainly from questions to the college, there's everything from, can I prescribe the chair for my dad or my grandfather because they need to have it signed off by an occupational therapist? And in that particular question, I said, why are you calling the college? I was like, well, I'm uncomfortable with that, so I just want some college backup so I can say no to my family member. But I think that is sort of reflective that the individual actually understood the relationship problem that might happen in terms of bias and all those other things, but because it was obviously efficient and going to be expeditious to get that signature, but in fact was putting that person in that position. And vendors, I think, do the same thing. You form relationships with your vendors who are a client in a different way. You're a customer, but they they see the power that you have in the prescription and access to services and equipment, and so they're going to create either unintended incentives or intended incentives, and I think you just have to be wary. And I agree with Eleanor, the principle of full disclosure, qualifying and limiting your services, even if you're providing services to a particular vendor or two, that they recognize you're not going to be exclusively providing for that vendor if the appropriate equipment is from something else. And kind of looking at the client who is the recipient of your service as somewhat a primary therapeutic relationship. And I think that's kind of a way to manage it. The only other one is really the payment side of it, where there is that risk of the slippery slope around conflict of interest, but justified in the benefits or interests of the client, because it's, if I can do it quickly and that vendor's going to pay for the service, and they bury that cost inside the cost that goes to Blue Cross or whatever, but really they're then going to pay you your fee, so the client doesn't have to pay the fee. So it's kind of, it feels like the right thing to do, but in fact you're misleading and misrepresenting the circumstance to the third-party funder or the insurance company. So I've had some questions around that, and there have been some investigations, I think, not by our college, but certainly in those circumstances. And the third thing I say that has come up sort of in just a sideways, just protect your, keep an eye out for information being used, potentially inappropriately, your registration number appearing somewhere on a bill that you didn't actually participate in, and those kinds of things. So I think it's really about the primary client. People have a right to buy what they want, and so there isn't restrictions on going down to your local drugstore or buying the scooter because you see it on the side of the street. But I think it's we could do a bit more education. Maybe a project for CAOT BC chapter. Some of those public information pieces that I think really are missing about promoting access and ensuring people get those services. There's a risk tool in your document, too, that you could start applying and see whether there's things that are going to be putting the clients in harm's way.
Hi, just in follow-up to a comment earlier about technology and social networking, I'm really interested in the college's perspectives. Mm-hmm. We run into that with both the occupational therapists and supervising rehab assistants who are on long-term brain injury files or even any kind of long-term file. I know what my personal stance is in terms of not ever accepting clients as friend requests, but I'm having to deal more and more of that with, I would say every single client has asked me that, and same with rehab assistants. I'm curious what you guys think. And text messaging and blogging, and I could go on and on, but...
Well, this is a really big issue, and you know, we've recognized at the college that in Ontario, this is a moving target, because the technology keeps changing. Every time you think you've nailed it down, oh, there's something new. One of the things that's happened in Ontario is that the College of Teachers has put out some guidelines for social networking for the teachers, because they started having trouble with teachers being asked to be friends on Facebook with some of the students, and then it just went haywire. And you can just imagine, because you can lock it down, but then what ends up happening is you've got to watch, because all of a sudden Facebook will have a new rule where all the locks are gone and you've got to start all over again. We had a student this summer with us from U of T, and she was doing a bit of a literature search on what's up with social media right now. So how are people using this? Is it good? Is it bad? Like, what's the deal? And really found that people are getting themselves into trouble because they think that they're doing something that is private, but nothing that goes on the computer is private. And that's the problem, and it lives there forever. And you might think you have control over something, but you don't really. And so if you're starting Facebook or any of these social networking things where patients' names go up there and then they can share that with two friends and it can go and go and go, patient confidentiality is just practically out the window. And also, one of the ways to think about this kind of thing is that these are called social networks. And we're not in social relationships with our clients. We're in a professional relationship. And that's got a higher level of accountability and responsibility. And so while we might feel a push to do this, we have to be really, really careful that the boundaries are going to be managed properly. And if they can't be, maybe we shouldn't be doing it. That confidentiality is going to be managed properly, and that your credibility as a professional is going to be maintained if you're being involved with any kind of the social networking thing. Because if you have your own Facebook page, be wary of that. Because what if your patients find you on there? There was an example of a doctor in England, and this has been documented, that she was on Facebook and she was talking, just innocuous things, but all of a sudden one of her patients sent her some white roses. because she had said on her Facebook page those were her favorite flowers. And so she started having this stalking thing started happening because her patient found out personal information about her that she would normally not share and started using that to gain an advantage with her. And so that's been a problem. There's been people fired for posting personal information on their Facebook pages because it had a bad influence on the hospital where they worked. And those kinds of things. So there's huge risks with doing stuff related to Facebook. But the jury's out in terms of, there's no rule from our college, I don't know about BC, that says no Facebook. But there are rules about confidentiality, about privacy, about behavior on becoming a therapist that's in the public domain. In our province, every single therapist name is up on a public register, so they're all public figures. And so if something happens and they can connect you to be a professional, you don't stop being a professional the minute you walk away from work. And the way you're perceived can be detrimental, and like it or not, occupational therapists are public people and there's a higher expectation of behavior. So that's just sort of my musings on this a little bit.
I think Eleanor's covered it. It's why it's really nice to hear this coming up here. I think we have to dig into it a bit more. But if you step back, the principles of practice when email wasn't really available, I can remember that, so that's how old I am. But the principles didn't change. You have a guideline that speaks to collecting, recording, and protecting client information. So that speaks to, that principle doesn't change, it just means the mode of delivery and the mechanism. So the explosive nature of the lack of control and potentially security from social networking is really the issue there. The principles haven't changed one bit, so the risk analysis should be very similar. What is the purpose for you to collect and disclose information in that environment? Is it information you'd be disclosing, you know, in other ways? Like, what information would be there? Would you be putting something in the record or collecting that information that you didn't otherwise need to have? So Facebook's, I guess, with a client. There's information there that probably wouldn't be relevant or wouldn't be information that you need to have in that client relationship. So it's really, you go right back to the principles of transparency, disclosure, and the protection of personal information, and in this case from both sides, from the professional boundaries perspective. But I think the document from the teachers is one I've taken a look at, and it's quite interesting. Again, the status of a regulated profession, whether you're doing something during your work hours or off your work hours, there's significant case law that ultimately you can be held accountable for behavior outside the work hour. So that's not necessarily going to control the box of activity anymore. Great question. I'd love to know your position, but you don't have to say it publicly. I think...
My question is around the our accountability for our support personnel, rehab assistants, etc. Do we have the same accountability for all those professional boundaries? And
if you, again, step back to the principles that are related to the assignment of occupational therapy services to support personnel, the supervision and monitoring is your responsibility, including ensuring that there are mechanisms in place that individual or individuals know the expectations around protection of privacy. So these were the policy pieces, because there's also law that backs you up on that. You know, the liability for related, liability is probably the wrong, the professional regulatory perspective on whether a person that was providing information or providing services on behalf of you as part of that intervention team, and you discover that they're also participating on Facebook with clients. I'd ask the question, well, if I've got support personnel as part of my everyday practice, what are the policies and procedures I have in place related to the sharing and collection and use of information? Similarly, the monitoring and supervision related to what things can be assigned, what things shouldn't be assigned, and your clinical and critical thinking around whether that person has the competencies. So the competency and understanding of protection of information is there. So I hope that answers the question. The relationship doesn't change in terms of the responsibility. Obviously, you can't control someone's behavior, but you can put into place those mechanisms that ensure someone at least understands the behavioral expectations, like you do already for how you submit your time and how you make sure you have recorded any client information and the services you're providing. So similarly, that they're responding that way, because ultimately you have the opportunity, I suppose, to terminate that relationship and it's no longer appropriate. Clients deserve to know what the expectations are for the service provision continuum, which might include the delivery of services by support personnel.
I'm just going to make a comment because I was very intrigued by the comment from the middle of the room about the mental health and having clients become colleagues, and very interesting in terms of professional boundaries. And I remember when we were developing our professional boundaries standards, one of the things we talked about is, when does that power differential end? So if you've got a therapeutic relationship with someone, when does it end? And we felt that if you were doing psychotherapy with a client, probably that power differential never ends. So it might be that the people that are now moving up into a colleague relationship, there is an inherent power differential that remains and would need to be recognized. And I think there would need to be policies and procedures around the relationship that happens with previous clients and what gets disclosed, because presumably they could have access to their chart, and maybe, you know, they all have a right to probably as well. But if you think that you're going to be treating someone who might eventually become a colleague, it's going to influence exactly what you're documenting. So there's a lot of risks involved with that. So I don't have the right answer, but I'm very intrigued. I think it's going to be a big challenge if that's the direction that your center is moving into. Very fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's not, and it's not renewed, because I think you raised this at our professional boundaries workshop in 2004. So we haven't attended to it. That's kind of disappointing. You can edit that out of the tape, Mary, when you get that. I think the piece for me is the person that was the client and is now moved into a collegial relationship and delivery of services is as much a part of that discussion to say, what are the boundaries and expectations? So while the responsibility remains with the regulated professional, I think there is probably room for that conversation, because if I was a patient and moved into now a support, a peer support or a position where I'm now helping deliver services, I'd want to know what happens, because I know you know about me. It's not that I know about you. I also know you know about me. And how is that information going to be handled? So I think there may be some toolkit or things we need to have more conversation around on guiding that professional boundary piece, or at least a toolkit that helps unpack that. The risk tool might help a little bit with that, but I think we need to probably pay some attention. Because I don't think it's unusual. Parents are involved in parent advisory committees at school and helping to find services. And family-centered therapy brings all sorts of other peer and relationships where someone might be a colleague. You might be someone in the environment might be being treated as a colleague who's had some sort of an event. So how does that work? So I think it's a really critical discussion that we need to have, Kim, so that there's guidance there before things go sideways. Thanks, everybody.